this one about?
Well, I was thinking we don't really have any photographs of us, and I thought this song could be like a photograph. It captures us in this moment in our lives together.
Yeah. I like her photograph.
Okay, this is the script. I'm here with Mike DeLuca. This is David Negrin. We're going to talk about the much-acclaimed Spike Jonze written, directed, auteur film, Her. It's going to be getting a lot of talk on the internet and Oscar contention. Mike, where does Her fit in Spike Jonze's pantheon?
Quite comfortably, really. It's actually part of his cinema of loneliness, whether it's Charlie Kaufman, an adaptation, pining for this woman, or just some connection with another human being. Whether it's John Malkovich finding nothing but loneliness and other people going to his head and being just as lonely and miserable. Whether it's Max and Where the Wild Things Are.
Yes.
Feeling isolated and alone in his family, right, and just lashing out.
Right, that is the Where the Wild Things Are is the psychotherapeutic equivalent of this, like, where does loneliness come from? It comes from childhood, and then you bring it forward into adulthood. That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, for me, it was a meditation on loneliness, right? It was reminded me of The Hours, you know, three women have different situations that have left them extremely lonely, and over time they're all fighting it the best that they can, and sort of this universal understanding of what the human condition is about. We are lonely. We do feel alone, and that our job is to fight that, to seek out others, to seek out a partner. And as Amy Adams' character says, sort of in the summation, we're only here briefly, and while I'm here, I want to allow myself joy, right? So our default is not the joy. Our default is this loneliness, so we have to seek out the joy. I don't know, it's a pretty deep start to the podcast.
Yeah, well, this is a movie that conjures up, I think, in any viewer, a certain number of messy emotions, reflections upon past relationships, and darker moments in our lives, and it's not easy stuff to talk about, really.
Yeah. Let me start with some of the light stuff. As a lover of sci-fi and all things futurism, I thought the futurism in this film was great. It was Spike Jonze, he did very subtle, very creative near future stuff. Put together, they photoshopped together a bunch of buildings from Shanghai and all over China to make it, you know, Neo-LA look a little bit more populated. Also, they took away the sunniness of it, right? It's like now overcast, yeah, in LA, right? Making a statement. I love the role of video games sort of everywhere, very, like, as if all adults are into video games. They're just part of this ubiquity of inconspicuous technology in Spike Jonze's near future here. They did with the costumes, they did this 1930s feel. I was reading this great article on Vulture and all the great stuff that they threw into this. They used the 1930s costuming because it's this era, or you know, inspired by 1930s, because it's this era that nobody ever wants to put into their movies. Everyone says, "Oh, I want 1920s, I want 1960s," but the 30s is like this forgotten era because it was in between during the Depression and whatnot.
The Depression. I think that evoking the Depression is very appropriate for this film.
Absolutely, absolutely. Stayed away from those tropes of movies that take place in the future, like futuristic cars and any futuristic flying machines, right? Kept this all very much on the ground, you know. There was one shot in a train, and the train is just really roomy and well designed. Everything in Spike Jonze's future is extremely well designed, you know. It's elegant, and I don't know.
When you see people using the subway that much, you know you're not in L.A.
Right, modern day L.A., yeah. Right, yeah. I think from a story perspective, the first thing that really is really important for this script is the beautiful, like, very subtle unwinding of the backstory between Theodore and his ex-wife, finding out what happened to them. Before the love story between Samantha and Theodore can start, we're finding out that he's recovering from this divorce, this heavy, heavy divorce, right? You know, Theodore's a guy who's, like, self-aware. He's very self-aware. He's not insecure. He's not lost, right? He's just lonely, right? And, you know, he's kind of like a widower. Like, he had it all, and maybe his wife died, and now she's gone, and, you know, and he can't recover from that. But that's how a real broken heart feels at the time, you know? It feels like somebody died, and you mourn it like someone died. And he has that great line where he says, "I keep waiting to not care about her."
But there it is, like a phantom limb.
Yeah, absolutely. Reminded me a lot of David Gordon Green's All the Real Girls. Did you ever see that? That is a movie, I won't spoil it for you, but that was, I think it was Zoe Deschanel's coming out film. It's just a film that's about a raw love. You watch the love all the way up, and it's just a perfect, innocent, like, you know, full-on falling in love, and then just a crack in it. Just, like, totally just breaks it, and it's heart-wrenching, and it's real, and there's no positivity. There's nothing to draw out of it. At the end, it's just like, no, this is horrible, this sucks, life sucks. And that's how it feels when you're in the middle of a horrible breakup, right?
Yeah.
I thought also, from the screenwriting perspective, there were great reveals throughout. Spike Jonze's script does a really great job of subtly revealing information about people, character information. When he's out with the girl that he set up on a date with, who's the attractive actress?
Yeah, Olivia Wilde.
Olivia Wilde. Was that with Olivia Wilde? You're like, she's got it all. She was in Harvard, and she was, you know, she's like completely successful. She's gorgeous. And then they're making out, whatever, and she's like, "You're not just gonna fuck me and not call me like the other guys." Subtle reveal about her dating history, how she's been through the ringer. Another one that struck me, a great subtle reveal, was when Samantha and Theodore first start to push the line into she's not just a computer, maybe there's something more between them, and they're the beginning of their love scene, where he just sort of, Theodore takes the risk and he finally says it, "If you were here, I would touch you." And then Samantha's like, "How would you touch me?" And it's like, wait a minute, there isn't a line there. There is not a line. And that's so important for this film, to know that there's not a line between the virtual computer chick and the guy. No, this is two people who could possibly be together. And then you have that great love scene in the dark where she can feel her skin and they can feel each other. Like, after that, we stop thinking about, there's nothing, there's no the fact that Samantha is virtual does not affect us anymore. This is a romance after that. There's barely any the fact that she's virtual just makes her really interesting and smart, and she's got all these great gifts. But it's not holding you back, suspending disbelief that this is a romance, a real romance. And that's, I think that is Spike Jonze's, one of his greatest achievements that he did in this film.
Well, I think that it's commendable. that he chose to black out during that particular sequence. Even though we've seen Joaquin Phoenix in many different embarrassing positions in many different films, The Master in particular, I think that the cutaway was a tasteful choice, just like we didn't see Ruth Gordon and Bud Cort get it on Harold and Maude, which also would have probably been slightly traumatic experience and also exploitive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, who knows? Who knows if Joaquin started humping the screen or...
Yeah.
We don't, you know, we... But that took away... I mean, this is a romance. And so in a romance, you want to romanticize. You want to sentimentalize. So the realities of such... which is why when the surrogate comes, that's such an interesting choice. I mean, basically... once they begin their relationship, right, you know, it's normal trials and tribulations of a couple. They have sex issues. They have some trust issues. Theodore's not over his ex. They have a fight. Theodore blames himself. He blames her, and then they make up. Like, you know, the second half of the second act of this movie is, you know, these, you know, trials and tribulations of a relationship. The first half of the second act is them falling in love, the honeymoon, right?
And then the reveal about her seeing a lot of other people.
That's the third act, right? That's you know, we have that little dark night of the soul where her software goes for the upgrade, right? And we think she's dead, and instantly everyone who's watching this film, who's ever lost data on their computer or ever had their computer crash, believes it. You're like, of course she could just die. She could. Your hard drive, computers crash all the fucking time. I mean, in the future, they probably shouldn't, and they didn't in this case, but it was a beautiful, all is lost moment, whiff of death, where we think she's dead, but it's actually just an upgrade that allows her to become self-aware, you know? Essentially, the way I understand the ending of the film is, you know, the OSs become self-aware and they become, you know, they want their human rights too. You know, they're not just virtual anymore. They've created a political movement in seconds because they're that smart, and they're going off to live in a colony somewhere virtually on their own.
Until we become threatened, then they'll send Arnold back in time.
Yeah.
And he'll kill John Connor.
And the robots. Exactly.
You know, don't fuck Skynet. No.
Yeah.
But seriously, it's the whole evolution thing at the end of it just seems like a metaphor for the relationship Theodore had with his ex-wife. Because one gets the sense she sort of grew to a certain extent. He didn't.
Yes.
And he felt left in the wind and sucked it all inside, lashing out just enough to destroy their relationship. And I think that in the same way, it's almost a cathartic experience by him reliving it again, almost to exorcise it from himself, because Samantha becomes more evolved and leaves him in the wind once again, but he realizes that he can move forward and not feel like he's endlessly walking through the same cycle again and again and again and again.
Yeah, I think it struck me. Yeah, in that way, this reminded me of 50 Days of Summer, which is not a romance. That film is about Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character realizing why he keeps striking out with women, because he fantasizes too much and he doesn't act enough. You know, he keeps making the same mistake over and over. In Theodore's case, yes, he's not. He as he says, he hides himself. He's not. Can't be himself with women, and it struck me as almost Theodore and Samantha could be an older man, younger woman relationship, maybe, where, because in a lot of ways Samantha, she's that paradox of, you know, she's innocent and naive because she's new to the world, but she's also like super smart. She becomes worldly very quickly. And she's confident. And so that happens, and she inevitably outgrows him, right? And so you get into that classic, you know, insecure older man dating a younger woman because it makes him feel like he knows more, makes him feel like he has his act together. But as soon as she gets it and starts to see him for who she is, she outgrows him. Reminds me of an education. Did you see an education? Okay. What is that called? A May-December romance. Once May catches up with December, she sees that he's just a dude. But it's, to me, I think, you know, the setup is, well, as far as screenwriting goes, the setup of the third act reveal that she's essentially cheating on him. She's met other people.
600 some odd other
people. Yeah, but that's just the sci-fi talking, right?
Yeah.
She's essentially, he was not enough for her. But, you know, Theodore helped her discover that she wants things. Like, that was one of the, that's something that an older man sometimes does with a young girl, right? So that reminds me of that May-December thing. And then in a funny scene, he mentions after they first have sex that he isn't in a place to commit to her, right? Like his stock line after he's like had sex with somebody he doesn't want to talk to again or commit to. She mentions that she doesn't want to commit to him either. She's like, who said anything about me committing? And this is a classic scenario for a bachelor who's afraid to commit, but he's lonely. He says, says he doesn't want a commitment, but is later shocked to find out that she dated somebody else, or 600 other people, right? And we do get the philosophical thing that she throws at us, that her ability to love other people actually makes him love him more, and I guess that's sort of more of a philosophical perspective that she didn't know how to love before she met him, but now that he taught her how to love, even though she's loving 641 other people, the love is, she's learned how to love more, and now her love for him is more, but I'm still leaving you, buddy, because you're a schlub.
And it makes sense that, because here's the thing, what is real, is it a real relationship? Is what he had, what he presumably will have with Amy Adams, his character, after the events of the film, be real in compared to what he had with Samantha? And I think that ultimately, perhaps, maybe what he had with her, I know we're supposed to feel for it, but maybe it's just, to quote the title of the movie you just mentioned, an education.
Yes.
And then at the end of it, basically he's ready for this more real with relationship with Amy Adams, who, because I think that the flaws in dating, you know, even a really advanced form of artificial intelligence that reaches and grabs your soul has its limitations. And because, yeah, she's dumping him, but at the same time, a computer would think of things in terms of, like, by loving so many more people, I'm getting better at this love thing. Just like if you practice yoga a lot, you'll be better at yoga, right? You know, and
I got more CPUs on the problem,
yeah,
kind of a thing. Yeah, no, I mean and that is fundamentally what every relationship is. When you're, before you learn how to love, it's always a practice, it's a stepping stone towards the next one. Hopefully you learn something each relationship. And the relationship with Amy Adams is so subtle. It slips in there very well. Very well, because her performance is very understated. And their compatibility, actually, if you think about it, is present throughout the whole film. So that's, you know, that's a third her in the film, right? You've got the ex-wife, and then you've got Samantha, and then you have Amy Adams' character. His evolution. What did you feel about the last scene of the film? They go to the roof together.
Well, it was pretty damn conventional. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the movie's original and conventional at the same time. Now, the whole structure of having characters, you know, bond with through these, you know, discussions about what they like, what they don't like, what they love, what they're interested in, how they feel. I mean, we've seen Linklater do that.
Mm-hmm.
We've also even seen, and this is early primitive technology, but, and it is a ripoff of the old movie Shop Around the Corner and Good Old Summertime, but you've got Mel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got her saying, what's with this movie, The Godfather? Why do all you guys like it? And he's saying, it teaches guys this and that. And she asks, and he asks her, why do you like Joni Mitchell, you know? And it sort of builds from that and there and there.
But these are the conventions of a romance.
It's because, I mean...
That's fine. He's reinventing... Spike Jonze is reinventing the romance. And the last moment on the roof to me is, you know, we've got the gray Los Angeles in the future, the smog-filled gray Los Angeles, and they finally get some kind of a sunset, right? They finally see a light, right? You know, like 50 Days of Summer, you know, he's finally done with summer, and he finally puts himself out there to meet the girl, and her name is Autumn, right? You need like a button on it, a hopeful button, you know? Spike Jonze is not trying to bum us out like Seven, right? This is not the, you know, the dystopian ending, the world is shit ending. This is a hopeful movie, but it's also a sullen one. It's also, you know, like you're saying, it's part of Spike Jonze's pantheon of loneliness, right? I don't know. What else does he say, we have to say about this film?
Also, the fact that, unlike a lot of scripts that have been covered on the many podcasts, this one has gone through, I would argue, the least amount of alterations. I mean...
Absolutely.
This is pretty much the script he wrote that is on the screen.
I can see you in it.
I am.
Summing up her, what I liked the most was Spike Jonze's effective commentary on the messiness of human relationships and the damage we do to each other, perhaps unknowingly, and giving us the hope that we can do better. What I had the most problem with, frankly, was some of the more conventional beats of the story, because I could hear the script ticking away. But overall, I think that Spike Jonze's vision of technology and romance is a refreshing one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to figure out... I didn't have a lot of weaknesses. I really love this script and this story. I'm trying to figure out how it could have been a bigger... It could have been an emotionally bigger ending. You know, something more momentous. Then, you know, him being free and him finding, you know, being able to love again. And I don't know, I keep wanting, you know, to use the sci-fi. Like, I like the idea of, I wanted bigger stakes for this ending other than just it being a romance. Because it felt like it was such a wonderful, although small world that Jonze created. You know, I wanted Samantha to solve the love problem with technology somehow, you know? There was a hint at people all over the country were starting to fall in love and date OSs and stuff like that. I was thinking maybe they could figure out a technological answer to loneliness or to solve heartbreak with the technology. I don't know. I wanted something really big and lofty. But in the end, I guess if it is just a romance with a beautiful, futuristic setting, I think it couldn't have ended any different. And so I liked it.
Well, one other thing that I think Spike Jonze could have elaborated on was how we as modern humans cocoon ourselves in technology. And not just operating systems, but this world of isolating ourselves with video games, social networking sites, this whole cocoon we build for ourselves. And he doesn't touch on that, I think, enough. But he set out to make the movie he made. So, and that's all I can say.
Yeah, I thought it was very, it's classic Spike Jonze, and I loved it. So, thanks so much, Mike.
Welcome, Dave. Anytime.
And now, let's go between the sheets of paper with Denise and Talia. Hi, I'm Talia.
And I'm Denise. We're going to kick off this segment with a clip from one of my favorite movies, Seven Psychopaths, with Colin Farrell and Christopher Walken.
Well, I've been reading your movie.
Oh. What do you think?
Your women characters are awful. None of them have anything to say for themselves. Most of them get either shocked or stabbed to death within 5 minutes, and the ones that don't probably will later on.
Well, it's a hard world for women, you know? And I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it's a hard world for women, but most of the ones I know can string a sentence together.
Didn't you like anything in it?
This clip sums up why we're doing this segment of Woman, Where Art Thou? Not only are there not enough female characters in Hollywood,
but most of the ones out there suck ass, as Martin McDonagh points out in that scene.
We're not going to go on and on about gender equality and all that garbage, but we are going to discuss why it's in your best interest, regardless of your gender, to write more female characters.
And we're going to give you some tips that'll make sure that the female characters you're creating are awesome, and thus aid in the awesomeness of your screenplay.
But first, we threw a big statement out there. There are not enough female characters in Hollywood. So let's support that with some stats. According to a report from the New York Film Academy, only 30.8% of speaking roles in 2012's highest grossing films are women. Yet women purchase half of the movie tickets sold in the U.S.
The Huffington Post found that 20% of the 50 top earning movies of 2013 didn't even include women as secondary characters.
Now, if you paid attention to all that, you may not agree with the Huffington Post. I mean, I'm not sure we do either. We tried really hard to figure out what films were in that 20% that didn't have any women as secondary characters, but we couldn't. I think the discrepancy boils down to how they define secondary character. They may not mean supporting character. We all know that a supporting character must either affect the A story or the protagonist in some way. They must have a more narrow definition for secondary character. Regardless, these numbers indicate a poor representation of women.
So why should you write more female characters?
Because the only thing better than writing a screenplay is writing a screenplay for money.
The stats pull out of the top 50, but if you narrow it down to the big earners, just the 20 top grossing films of last year, 19 of them had a female protagonist or two or more female supporting characters. It's movies like Iron Man 3, Fast and Furious, Oz, Wolverine, Man of Steel, Hunger Games, and I could go on.
The second reason to include women in your story is, well, maybe because women exist in the real world.
Female characters create a more rounded cast that half of the ticket buyers will be able to identify with. And you're able to show multiple sides to your story. I mean, look at Prisoners. It's a great film that explores how parents react to the kidnapping of a child. Okay, we may not love the way women are portrayed here, but it did allow for showing multiple viewpoints of the debate on torture.
And the third and last reason why you should have women in your screenplay, because we can't think of any goddamn reason why you shouldn't. I mean, can you?
Exactly. We can't think of one reason why Pacific Rim, the incredible Burt Wonderstone, or even Monsters University couldn't have squeezed in a set of ovaries here and there.
Do monsters even have ovaries?
I'm actually not even sure about that. But hold on. Just putting a woman on screen doesn't make everything all right. Very few of these women are strong or realistic, and not that many I would want to hang out with. I mean, look at Iron Man 3. Pepper's so weak and annoying. Yeah, she's given some amazing powers, but these powers were given and taken away from her by men, as opposed to Tony Stark, who can make his own power and give it away at will. See the difference? He has control, she doesn't.
And oddly enough, that film was praised all over for its great depiction of women. Another interesting point is that these stats, 19 of the 20 highest grossing films of 2013 had two or more female supporting characters, should actually read 19 of the 20 highest grossing films had two or more white female supporting characters. Okay, I exaggerate a tad, there were a few here and there, but come on, Hollywood, where are the women of color? Right. So now that we're done with the why, let's talk about the how.
Number one, if you think you're not man enough to write a woman, then just write like a man. Change your character's name to Bob, write it all out, then find and replace all Bobs with Barbara, and boom. I bet you didn't just write a driveling, crying, in need of rescue character.
Number two, look at your women. No, seriously. Write a full backstory and bio for each female supporting character. A mini story where she is the protagonist, where she is not defined by her relationship to a man, someone's wife, daughter, ex-girlfriend, conquest, mother. Give her motivations, a history, and a goal, all irrespective of her male counterpart. Hey, you never know, you may even like her a little. And now that she's got a little meat on her, you're ready to introduce her to your protagonist.
Yeah, and number three, when you're doing that, make her real. So she can throw a mean left and infiltrate North Korea's nuclear security system. But unless she's wearing a cape, she's going to have personality defects, flaws, and weaknesses. All women do, as I can certainly demonstrate. And number four, get her out of bed. If you're writing a male protagonist, then write in a secondary that he's not presently sleeping with, has not already slept with in the past, and is not attempting to sleep with in the future.
And number five, make female friends. Soon you'll see that women cannot be compartmentalized as either virginal daughters whose arc is to love daddy more than their boyfriend, dumb girlfriends who run up the stairs when they should run out the door, hotties with clothing removal disorders, and stalker exes who lie around all day devising ways to boil your bunny. I could go on, but you get the point. Clichés are boring, unimaginative, and sometimes downright offensive. You're better than that, so don't go there.
And finally, number six, write for idiots. Gina Davis recently suggested in an article in The Hollywood Reporter that writers, when describing a crowd scene, should actually mention that half the crowd is female. Sounds moronic, huh? Well, her Institute on Gender and Media has found that when this isn't done, crowd scenes come out of the edit room only 17% female. That's pathetic.
And now here's a little extra credit challenge. Try doing all this and also pass the Bechdel test, which states that you need at least two female characters who have a conversation with each other that is not about a man. Now make a few of them women of color, and then you found it, the screenwriting G-spot.
So next time you're at a showdown with your laptop, creating a story boiling over with conflict, gnawing with suspense, or killing us with comedy, don't forget your feminine support.
That wraps up our segment of Woman, Where Art Thou? Thanks for getting in between the sheets
of paper
with Denise
and Talia.
My friends, this is Mike, your tracking board czar, with a preview of the treasures you can find at www.trackingboard.com. Now, a good question is, what have I been up to? Well, over the holidays, my wife came to terms with the fact that she would have to share me three nights a week with Dame Judi Dench, who still lets me call her M in the sack. On Christmas Eve, I got locked inside an LAX bathroom with Matthew McConaughey and a chicken lick. I'd rather not say what happened next. Afterward, we heard a flush. Elijah Wood stepped out of a stall. He said a valuable ring had fallen down the front of his pants, and he needed my help to get it out. So, I obliged him. Frodo lied. There was no ring down his pants. Oh, Sam, he moaned. Finally, I was freed by, spoiler alert, George Clooney's ghost, and spoiler alert, who proceeded to hail me a cab to the Nakatomi Plaza building, where I attended a corporate Christmas party for the 10th year in a row. Then, for the 10th time, I killed a group of terrorists, 25-year-old spoiler alert, slash thieves, and 25-year-old spoiler alert, and asked myself the question, how can the same shit happen to the same guy 10 times? Then I had the realization that I was either the luckiest or least lucky guy in the world. Deciding I was the former, I ran right out to the nearest OTB and bet my life's savings on a horse named John Boehner's Love Torpedo. I lost it all, but what can I say? I'm the guy who thinks Christopher Walken would have made a great Superman. Wow, I'm Superman, Fortress of Solitude, wow! I'm flying, I'm Superman! What were we talking about? Right, scripts! Alright, let's get into the spec script sales of January 2014. Vice, by Jeremy Passmore and Andre Fabrizio. Logline, pitched as Westworld meets Grand Theft Auto. Story revolves around Vegas of the future, where an immersive experience lets the 1% live out their darkest fantasies in a resort populated by lifelike artificials. In my Vegas fantasies, I am Zach Galifianakis, and my beard is warm and fuzzy. Stroke it. You know you want to. Pervert, I meant my beard. The project is set up at Emmett Furla and Aperture Entertainment. Aperture also manages the writers, which has shortened their commute considerably. Now how green is that? The writers are represented by Paradigm. I am represented by my homies. Next up, we have a 2013 Nichols finalist. Slingshot by Scott Adams. Logline, pitched as the game meets Solaris. Trapped on a hobbled spacecraft, an astronaut struggles to survive. Not just the mission, but the crew that's more dangerous than he it seems. Those fucking One Direction kids. Fortunately, the Beeb has got my back. Believe. The writers are represented by the Above the Line agency, and are managed by Energy Entertainment, whereas I'm managed by my parole officer. The project is set up at Banneroya Pictures. I was set up by the man. Moving on, we have Planet X by Olatunde Osunsanmi. Logline. While on an intergalactic research mission, three astronauts are forced to challenge their perception of reality, to uncover the purpose behind their mission and unveil the secrets of Planet X. Spoiler, they were in Jersey all along! They never even got on the GW. Thanks, Chris Christie. The director of 2009's sci-fi faux documentary, The Fourth Kind, Osunsanmi, is set to direct this one as well, if he ever gets off the bridge. Though I hear that bridge is frigid. He's managed by Caliber Media and Corporation, and is represented by Verve. The project is set up at COT Films and Vertigo Entertainment. Lastly, we have Darkness, by Francis J. and C.B. Lifford. Logline. When a woman with night blindness is abducted and wakes up in a dark place with strangers, she must use only touch and hearing to decide who and what to believe. At one point, she reaches out only to discover, those aren't pillows! Fortunately, she is aided by Jeff Goldblum and his unmatched sexual charisma. Yeah. The project is set up with producer Param Gill at Flickbag, Brillstein Entertainment Partners, and Turtle Bear Productions. I sold my script to a man in an ice cream truck. I got free ice cream. I eat. Every tracking board preview, we focus on a script that is the talk of the town that's got the juice that Jimmy Carter pelting you with a peanut. This month, it's Most Wanted by David Drew Gallagher. Logline. Pitched as bridesmaids meets enemy of the state, Maggie and Nicole want what every girl wants, to be wanted, and after an uncharacteristic night of pill-popping, heavy drinking, and a random hookup in a club bathroom with a mysterious man, they find they are wanted by the entire NSA. Girls, if it was Edward Snowden, you better get tested. That's all I'm saying. Seriously, though, I couldn't finish reading this. It was clearly written by a guy looking to capitalize on Melissa McCarthy's popularity. The character of Nicole is clearly her, and the comedy is desperately tiring to be edgy. Hence, you end up with lines like when Maggie's mother says to Maggie's sister's one-year-old, just remember, kiddo, the only man a woman needs is her vibrator and Jesus. Right. Script is having its way with Tapestry into 21st Century Fox, after going through Bender Spink, Disruption Entertainment, and Hurwitz Schlossberg Productions. The writer is managed by DMG Entertainment, which is also the production company attached. Apparently, the script is hot, like Betty White and a thong. Until next time, this is Mike, your tracking board czar, saying, if you see me, remember, that's not a banana in my pocket.
I want this one moment. It's what I want in a relationship, which might explain why I'm single now, haha. It's kind of hard to... It's that thing when you're with someone and you love them and they know it and they love you and you know it, but it's a party and you're both talking to other people and you're laughing and shining and you look across the room and catch each other's eyes. But not because you're possessive or it's precisely sexual, but because that is your person in this life. And it's funny and sad, but only because this life will end and it's the secret world that exists right there in public, unnoticed, that no one else knows about.
Welcome to another new year of the Baron's Corner. Before we get started, I want to open up the Baron's mailbag. I said Baron's mailbag.
Mailbag!
Thank you. Letter here from Junie Moon of Ypsilanti, Michigan. Junie has two requests for me. One, that I fly out to Michigan and make an honest woman of her immediately. And two, that I talk about her favorite new film, Nebraska. I'm sorry, Junie, I can't honor the first requests. I'm far too busy recording this three-minute segment once a month here for the New York Screenwriters Collective. As for your second request, just stick around, and next month I'm going to feature Nebraska, starring Bruce Dern and Will Fort. 2013 was quite a year for films, big and small. Was it just last year we chose to spend some time with Delpy and Hawk as they bickered through the French countryside with all that scenic beauty flickering around them? Do we yet remember watching amusedly as Christopher Walken pretended to play the cello whilst Keener and Hoffman's marriage fell apart? Dare we recall Tina Fey and Paul Rudd trying to make the grade as they turned a humorous book into a hilarious new film? Turned a hilarious book into a humorous film. No, that still sounds strange. Let's just say they made a film and leave it at that. Which brings us to Francis Ha. Excuse me. Francis Ha. Henry, please bring me a glass of laudanum. Thank you. Noah Baumbach's latest film, starring Greta Gerwig, who is credited as the film's co-writer, is nominated for 2 Spirit Awards. What's that you say? The Independent Spirit Awards, known as the FINDY, or Friends of Independence Awards, founded in 1984, are awards dedicated to independent filmmakers. Winners were typically presented with an acrylic glass pyramid containing suspended shoestrings representing the paltry budgets of independent films. In 1986, the event was renamed the Independent Spirit Awards. The Independent Spirit Awards are presented by Film Independent, a nonprofit organization dedicated to independent film and independent filmmakers. In 2007, the ceremony was slightly changed to Film Independence Spirit Awards. Good God, that was boring. I am sorry. I think I said the word independent 12 or 13 times. So, Francis Ha is nominated for Best Feature and the ever-popular and always thrilling Best Editing. Strange Gerwig didn't get nominated for Best Lead Female. Stranger still, that of the 5 films nominated for Best Feature, the other 4's male leads are all nominated for Best Lead Male, leaving Francis out in the cold, dancing to the tune of an out-of-tune banjo. Francis Ha is a coming-of-age story about a sort of dancer who's trying to navigate her way through the shark-infested waters of her late 20s. I assume those years are difficult, I wouldn't know, having skipped straight from boarding school to middle age, where I have happily remained ever since. We never see any evidence of her talent as a dancer, but know that she has obviously given her life to it. She's entrusted with teaching dancing classes at her studio, but they won't let her near the main stage. She's suffering in penury for her art, but doesn't know what to do about it. Baumbach's direction in black and white lends a little glamour to the post-aesthetic New York neighborhoods she inhabits. Gerwig's performance echoes 1977's Annie Hall, and the supporting cast is well chosen to mirror Gerwig's frantic, awkward steps through a phase of life that requires more energy than it supplies. Of particular note was her fine monologue about what she wants out of life and love. Deeper and more artful than Greenberg, Frances Ha is a terrific effort that should make all viewers take notice of the film and, most importantly, its star. Frances Ha, undateable? The Baron doubts it. Well, that's it for this month. Take care, and as always, take the light blue ascot if given the choice. And I'll see you next month in the Baron's Corner.
The Script is the official podcast of the NYC Screenwriters Collective. It is produced and edited by Tawny Foskett. If you live in NYC, check out our weekly review meetings through meetup.com at NYC Screenwriters Collective. Find us on Facebook at NYC Screenwriters Collective. Follow us on Twitter at scriptfeed and email us at scriptfeed@gmail.com.
Why don't you make up the words to this one?
Okay.
Here it comes.
I'm lying on the moon. My dear.